Hey guys, this is Horror Fan, and welcome back to my podcast on Anchor. Today, I'm going to do the horror talk of Lizzie Borden. If you guys ever heard of her, that's good for those of you who never heard of her, including me. Lizzie Borden, full name, Lizzie Andrew Borden, born July 19, 1860, died on June 1st, 1927. Was an American woman tried and acquitted of the August 4, 1892 axe murders of her father and stepmother in Fall River, Massachusetts. No one else was charged in the murders, and despite all stressing from other residents, Borden spent the remainder of her life in Fall River. She died of pneumonia at age 66, just days before the death of her older sister, Emma. I mean, I never heard of Lizzie Borden until a couple years ago. Ostracism was an atheist democratic procedure in which any citizen could be expelled from the city state of Athens for 10 years. So, yeah. The Borden murders and trials received widespread publicity throughout the United States, and along with Borden herself, they remain a topic in American popular culture to the present day. They have been depicted in numerous films, theatrical productions, literary works, and folk rhymes, and are still very well known in the Fall River area. She was born in Fall River, Massachusetts, United States. Then she died where she was born at the age of 66 years old. 1 month after she turned 60, no, sorry, no, sorry. 1 month, so sorry about that. 1 month before she was going to turn 67. Her resting place is at the Oak Grove Cemetery. Her other names, just Lizbeth Borden. She was known for a suspected homicide. Before I get on to the Horror Talk Lizzie Borden, don't forget to follow me on Anchor and Spotify. Let's get on to Lizzie Borden. Okay, early life. Lizzie Andrew Borden was born July 16, 1860 in Fall River, Massachusetts to Sarah Anthony Borden, maiden name Morse, born 1823, died 1863, and Andrew Jackson Borden, born 1822, died 1892. Her father, who was of English and Welsh descent, grew up in very modest surroundings and struggled financially as a young man, despite being the descendant of wealthy and influential residents. Andrew eventually prospered in manufacturing and selling furniture and caskets, then became a successful property developer. He was a director of several textile mills and owned considerable commercial property. He was also president of the Union Savings Bank and the director of the Durfee Safe Deposit and Trust Co. At his death, his estate was valued at $300,000. That's equivalent to $9 million in 2021. And this year, $9,630,000 in this year. Despite his wealth, Andrew was known for his frugality. For instance, the Borden home lacked indoor plumbing, although at the time it was a standard accommodation for the wealthy. It was in an affluent area, but the wealthiest residents of Fall River, including Andrew's cousins, generally lived in the more fashionable neighborhood, The Hill, which was further from the city's industrial areas. Borden and her older sister, Emma Lenora Borden, born 1851, died 1927, had a relatively religious upbringing and attended Central Congregational Church. As a young woman, Lizzie was very involved in church activities, including teaching Sunday school children of recent immigrants to the U.S. She was involved in religious organizations such as the Christian Endeavor Society, for which she served as secretary treasurer, and contemporary social movements such as the Women's Christian Temperance Union. She was also a member of the Ladies Fruit and Flower Mission. Three years after the death of Lizzie's mother, Sarah, Andrew married Abby Durfee Gray, born 1828, died 1892, Lizzie stated that she called her stepmother Mrs. Borden and disagreed on whether they had a cordial relationship. She believed that Abby had married her father for his wealth. That's like, I mean, that does happen, obviously. Bridget Sullivan, whom they call Maggie, the Borden's 25-year-old live-in maid who had immigrated to the U.S. from Ireland, testified that Lizzie and Emma rarely ate meals with their parents. In May 1892, Andrew killed multiple pigeons in his barn with a hatchet, believing they were attracting local children to hunt them. Lizzie had recently built a roost for the pigeons, and it has been commonly recounted that she was upset over his killing of them, though the veracity of this had been disputed. A family argument in July 1892 prompted both sisters to take extended vacations in New Bedford. After returning to Fall River a week before the murders, Lizzie chose to stay in a local rooming house for 4 days before returning to the family residence. Because I was laying it on my stomach, but not really. But yeah, 1 second. Give me a second. Okay, that's better. Okay. Tension had been growing within the Borden family in the months before the murders, especially over Andrew's gifts of real estate to various branches of Abby's family. After their stepmother's sister received a house, the sisters demanded and received a rental property, the home they had lived in until their mother died, which they purchased from their father for only $1. A few weeks before the murders, they sold the property back to their father for $5,000. That's like equivalent to $151,000 last year. The night before the murders, John Vinnicum Morris, the brother of Lizzie and Emma's deceased mother, and Lizzie and Emma's uncle, visited and was invited to stay for a few days to discuss business matters with his brother-in-law, Andrew. Some writers have speculated that their conversation, mainly about property transfer, may have aggravated an already tense situation. For several days before the murders, the entire household had been violently ill. A family friend later speculated that mutton left on the stove to use in meals over several days was the cause, but Abby had feared poison given that Andrew had not been a famous man. Mutton, it's like lamb, hogget, and mutton, generally sheep meat. So, yeah. Then the murders. So John Morris arrived on August 3 and slept in the guest room that night. After breakfast the following day, at which Andrew, Abby, Lizzie, John, and the Borden's maid, Bridget or Maggie Sullivan, were present, Andrew and John went to the sitting room where they chatted for nearly an hour. Morris left around 8:48 a.m. to buy a pair of oxen and visit his niece in Fall River, planning to return to the Borden home for lunch at noon. Andrew left for his morning walk sometime after 9 a.m. Niece Emma. Although cleaning the guest room was one of Lizzie and Emma's regular chores, Abby went upstairs between 9 a.m. and 10:30 a.m. to make the bed. According to the forensic investigation, Abby was facing her killer at the time of the attack. She was first struck on the side of the head with a hatchet, which cut her just above the ear, causing her to turn and fall face down on the floor, creating contusions on her nose and forehead. Her killer struck her multiple times, delivering 17 more direct hits to the back of her head, killing her. When Andrew returned around 10:30 a.m., his key failed to open the door, so he knocked. Sullivan went to unlock the door, finding it jammed. She uttered a curse. She would later testify that she heard Lizzie laughing immediately after this. She did not see Lizzie, but stated that the laughter was coming from the top of the stairs. This was considered significant as Abby was dead by this time, and her body would have been visible to anyone on the home's second floor. Lizzie later denied being upstairs and testified that her father had asked her where Abby was, to which she replied that a messenger had delivered Abby a summons to visit a sick friend. Lizzie stated that
She had then removed Andrew's boots and helped him into his slippers before he lay down on the sofa for a nap, a detail contradicted by the crime scene photos, which show Andrew wearing boots. She then informed Sullivan of a department store sale and offered her permission to attend, but Sullivan felt unwell and went to take a nap in her bedroom instead. Sullivan testified that she was in her third floor room, resting from cleaning windows when just before 11:10 a.m., she heard Lizzie call from downstairs, quote, "Maggie, come quick, father's dead. Somebody came in and killed him," end quote. Andrew was slumped on the couch in the downstairs sitting room, struck 10 or 11 times with a hatchet-like weapon. One of his eyes had been split cleanly in two, suggesting that he had been asleep when attacked. His still bleeding wounds suggested a very recent attack. Dr. Bowen, the family's physician, arrived from his home across the street and pronounced both victims dead. Detectives estimated that Andrew's death had occurred at approximately 11 o'clock a.m. Now the investigation. So, Lizzie Borden's initial answers to the police officers' questions were at times strange and contradictory. Initially, she reported hearing a groan, a scrapping noise, or a distress call before entering the house. 2 hours later, she told police she had heard nothing and entered the house, not realizing anything was wrong. When asked where her stepmother was, she recounted Abby receiving a note asking her to visit a sick friend. She also stated that she thought Abby had returned and asked if someone could go upstairs and look for her. Sullivan and a neighbor, Mrs. Churchill, were halfway up the stairs, their eyes level with the floor, when they looked into the guest room and saw Abby lying face down. Most of the officers interviewed Borden reported that they disliked her attitude. Some said she was too calm and polite. Despite her attitude and changing alibis, nobody bothered to check her for bloodstains. Police did search her room, but it was a courtesy inspection. At the trial, they admitted to not doing a proper search because Borden was not feeling well. They were subsequently criticized for their lack of diligence. In the basement, police found two hatchets, two axes, and a hatchet head with a broken handle. The hatchet head was suspected of being the murder weapon, as the break in the handle appeared fresh, and the ash and dust on the head, unlike that on the other bladed tools, appeared to have been deliberately applied to make it look as if it had been in the basement for some time. However, none of these tools were removed from the house. Because of the mysterious illness that had stricken the household before the murders, the family's milk and Andrew's and Abby's stomachs removed during autopsies performed in the Borden dining room were tested for poison. None was found. Residents suspected Lizzie of purchasing hydrocyanic acid in a diluted form from the local drugstore. She defended that she inquired about the acid so she could clean her furs, despite the local medical examiner's testimony that it did not have antiseptic properties. Lizzie and Emma's friend Alice Russell decided to stay with them the night following the murders, while Morris spent the night in the attic guest room, contrary to later accounts that he slept in the murder site guest room. Police were stationed around the house on August 4, during which an officer said he had seen Borden enter the cellar with Russell carrying a kerosene lamp and a slope pail. He stated he saw both women exit the cellar, after which Borden returned alone. Though he could not see what she was doing, he stated it appeared she was bent over the sink. The next day, August 5, Morris left the house and was mobbed by hundreds of people. Police had to escort him back to the house. On August 6, police conducted a more thorough search of the house, inspecting the sister's clothing and confiscating the broken-handled hatchet head. That evening, a police officer and the mayor visited the Bordens, and Lizzie was informed that she was a suspect in the murders. The following day, Russell entered the kitchen to find Borden tearing up a dress. She explained that she planned to put it on the fire because it was covered in paint. It was never determined whether it was a dress she wore on the day of the murders. Oh, okay, that's interesting. Inquest Borden appeared at the inquest hearing on August 8th. Her request to have her family attorney present was refused under a state statute providing that an inquest must be held in private. She had been prescribed regular doses of morphine to calm her nerves, which could have affected her testimony. Her behavior was erratic, and she often refused to answer a question, even if the answer could be beneficial to her. She often contradicted herself and provided alternating accounts of the morning in question, such as saying she was in the kitchen reading a magazine when her father arrived home, then saying she was in the dining room doing some ironing, and then saying she was coming down the stairs. She also said she removed her father's boots and put slippers on him, while police photographs clearly showed him still wearing his boots. Like, what? I'm not sure. The district attorney was very aggressive and confrontational. On August 11, Borden was served with a warrant of arrest and jailed. The inquest testimony, the basis for the modern debate regarding her guilt or innocence, was later ruled inadmissible at her trial. In June 1893, contemporaneous newspaper articles noted that Borden possessed a stolid demeanor and bit her lips flush and bent toward Attorney Adams. It was also reported that the testimony provided in the inquest had caused a change of opinion among her friends, who have heretofore strongly maintained her innocence. The inquest received significant press attention nationwide, including an extensive 3-page write-up in the Boston Globe. A grand jury began hearing evidence on November 7th, and Borden was indicted on December 2. Trial and acquittal. Borden's trial took place in New Bedford starting on June 5, 1893. Prosecuting attorneys were Jose M. Knowlton and future United States Supreme Court Justice William H. Moody. Defending were Andrew V. Jennings, Melvin O. Adams, and former Massachusetts Governor George D. Robinson. 5 days before the trial's commencement on June 1, another axe murder occurred in Fall River. This time, the victim was Bertha Manchester, who was found hacked to death in her kitchen. The similarities between the Manchester and Borden's murders were striking and noted by jurors. However, Jose Correa de Melo, a Portuguese immigrant, was later convicted of Manchester's murder in 1894 and was determined not to have been in the vicinity of Fall River at the time of the Borden murders. A prominent point of discussion in the trial or press coverage was the hatchet head found in the basement, which was not convincingly demonstrated by the prosecution to be the murder weapon. Prosecutors argued that the killer had removed the handle because it would have been covered in blood. One officer testified that a hatchet handle was found near the hatchet head, but another officer contradicted this. Though no bloody clothing was found at the scene, Russell testified that on August 8, 1892, she had witnessed Borden burn a dress on the kitchen stove, saying it had been ruined when she brushed against wet paint. During the trial, the defense never attempted to challenge this statement. Lizzie Borden's presence at home was also a point of dispute during the trial. According to testimony, Sullivan entered the second floor at around 10:58 a.m. and left Lizzie and her father downstairs. Lizzie told several people that at the time she went into the barn and was not in the house for 20 minutes or possibly half an hour. Jaime Lubinsky testified for the defense that he saw Lizzie leaving the barn at 11:03 a.m. and Charles Gardner confirmed the time. At 11:10 a.m., Lizzie called Sullivan downstairs, told her Andrew had been murdered, and ordered her not to enter the room. Borden sent her to get a doctor. Both victims' heads had been removed during autopsy, and the skulls were admitted as evidence during the trial and presented on June 5, 1893. Upon seeing them in the courtroom, Borden fainted. Evidence was excluded that Borden had sought to purchase prussic acid or hydrogen cyanide, purportedly for cleaning a sealskin cloak from a local druggist the day before the murders. The judge ruled that the incident was too remote in time to have any connection. The presiding associate judge, Justin Dewey, who had been appointed by Robinson when he was governor, delivered a lengthy summary that supported the defense as his charge of to the jury before it was sent to deliberate on June 20, 1893. After an hour and a half of deliberation, the jury acquitted Borden of the murders. She exited the courthouse and told reporters she was, quote, the happiest woman in the world, end quote. The trial has been compared to the later trials of Brutal Hauptmann, Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, and O.J. Simpson as a landmark in publicity and public interest in the history of American legal proceedings. Now, here is a speculation. Although acquitted at trial, Borden remains the prime suspect in her father's and stepmother's murders. Writer Victoria Lincoln proposed in 1967 that Borden might have committed the murders while in a fugue state. Another prominent suggestion was that she was physically and sexually abused by her father, which drove her to kill him. There is little evidence to support this, but incest is not a topic that would have been discussed at the time. And the methods for collecting physical evidence would have been quite different in 1892. Disbelief was intimidated in local papers at the time of the murders and was revisited by scholar Marshall Carlisle in a 1992 essay. In his 1984 novel, Lizzie Mystery author Ed McBain suggested that Borden committed the murders after being caught in an affair with Sullivan. McBain elaborated on his speculation in a 1999 interview, speculating the Abbey had caught Lizzie and Sullivan together and had reacted with and with horror and disgust, and that Lizzie had killed Abby with a candlestick. When Andrew returned, she had confessed to him but killed him in a rage with the hatchet when he reacted precisely as Abby had. McBain further speculates that Sullivan disposed of the hatchet somewhere else afterward. In her later years, Borden was rumored to be gay. Still, there was no such speculation about Sullivan, who found other employment after the murders and later married a man she met while working as a maid in Butts, Montana. She died in Butts in 1948, where she allegedly gave a deathbed confession to her sister, stating that she had changed her testimony on the stand to protect Borden. Ooh, hello, that's something. Another significant suspect is John Moore, Lizzie's maternal uncle, who rarely met with the family after his sister died, but has slept in the house the night before the murders. According to law enforcement, Moore had provided in, quote, absurdly perfect and over-detailed alibi for the death of Abby Borden, end quote. He was considered a suspect by police for a period. Others noted as potential suspects in the crimes include Sullivan, possibly in retaliation for being ordered to clean the windows on a hot day. What? The day of the murders was sweltering, and at the time, she was still recovering from the mystery illness that had struck the household. A man named William Borden, suspected to be Andrew's illegitimate son, who was noted as a possible suspect by writer Arnold Brown, who surmised in his book Lizzie Borden, The Legend, The Truth, The Final Chapter, that William had tried and failed to extort money from his father. However, author Leonard Rebello extensively researched William Borden in Brown's book and proved he was not Andrew Borden's son. Although Emma had an alibi at Fairhaven about 15 miles 24 kilometers from Fall River, crime writer Frank Spearing proposed in his 1984 book, Lizzie, that she might have secretly visited the residence to kill her parents before returning to Fairhaven to receive the telegram informing her of the murders. Um, later life, after the trial, the Borden sisters moved into a large Morden house in the Hill neighborhood in Fall River. Around this time, Lizzie began using the name Lisbeth A. Borden at their new house, which Lisbeth dubbed Maplecroft. They had a staff that included live-in maids, a housekeeper, and a coachman. Because Abby was ruled to have died before Andrew, her estate went first to Andrew, and then at his death, passed to his daughters as part of his estate. A considerable settlement, however, was paid to settle claims by Abby's family. Despite the acquittal, Borden was ostracized by Fall River society. Her name was again brought into the public eye when she was accused of shoplifting in 1897 in Providence, Rhode Island. In 1905, shortly after an argument over Lisbeth's party for actress Nance O'Neill, Emma moved out of the house and never saw her sister again. Oh, wow. Death. Borden was ill in her last year following the removal of her gallbladder. She died of pneumonia on June 1, 1927 in Fall River. Funeral details were not published and few attended. 9 days later, Emma died from chronic nephritis at the age of 76 in a nursing home in Newmarket, New Hampshire. Having moved to this location in 1923 for health reasons and to avoid renewed attention following the publication of another book about the murders, the sisters, neither of whom had ever married, were buried side by side in the family plot in Oak Grove Cemetery. At the time of her death, Borden was worth over $250,000, equivalent to $5,233,000 in 2021. She owns a house on the corner of French Street and Belmont Street, several office buildings, shares in several utilities, two cars, and a large amount of jewelry. She left $30,000, equivalent to $628,000 in 2021, to the Fall River Animal Rescue League, and $500, equivalent to $10,000 in 2021, in trust for the perpetual care of her father's grave. Her closest friend and a cousin each received $6,000, which is today $126,000. Substantial sums at the time of the estate's distribution in 1927, and numerous friends and family members each received between $1,000 and less, equivalent to $21,000 in 2021, and $5,000, equivalent to $105,000 in 2021. In culture, scholar Anne Schofield notes that Borden's story has tended to take one or the other of two fictional forms. The tragic romance and the feminist quest, the story of Lizzie Borden, has been created and recreated through rhyme and fiction. It has taken on the qualities of a popular American myth or legend that effectively links the present to the past. The Borden House is now a museum and operates a bed and breakfast with 1890s styling. Pieces of evidence used in the trial, including the axe head, are preserved at the Fall River Historical Society. Let me do part two, 1 second.